Meanwhile, I just heard that J Street had his convention there, and Biden gave a long-term speech.
I don't know. Okay, let's get started. Here we go. Our topic for tonight is the American Jewry in the aftermath of World War II, with a special focus on anti-Semitism, and even more importantly than anti-Semitism, Jewish perceptions of the existence of anti-Semitism. And I'll explain why the Jewish perception angle is actually more important than the anti-Semitism itself. Okay, so the joy of American victory in World War II was tempered by sadness over the Holocaust, that where everyone else was celebrating VE Day and VJ Day, yes, the American Jews were celebrating too, and especially for those service members who were abroad, this was a major moment in their lives that the war was over, but for Jews who were cognizant of what's going on in Jewish communities around the world, yes, there's victory, but there's also a lot of sadness. American Jews realized that they had escaped death because their parents or their grandparents had wisely decided to move to America a few decades earlier. You know, if not for grandma so-and-so making the boat, we would have been dead. That's the attitude that many American Jewish families had. And so they understood that they were lucky. They also understood that there was a major responsibility for the economic and social rehabilitation of Holocaust survivors, and that that burden was going to be borne primarily by American Jewry, the last surviving big and prosperous, wealthy American Jewish community. But before we take on the role of rehabilitating the survivors and whatever else the American the Jewish communal agenda will be, another question is, do you even want to be Jewish? Maybe after Auschwitz, the price of retaining Jewish identity is too high. And since in America it is possible to jettison that identity altogether if you really wanted to, maybe people will. And the answer is that some American Jews will do that to cast it all aside. But the majority of American Jews would reject that attitude of despair. The concept of chosenness did take a hit. And the attitude was, let God choose someone else for a change. And there were many who doubted God's existence. And the notion that God is dead, response to theodicy, became popular among some American Jews, but only some. The vast majority retained their desire to identify Jewishly and in a religious fashion, certainly a watered-down one without a whole lot of observance. The observance is in steep decline. But the ideas of, you know, retaining your Judaism in minimal form still had wide popularity. The American Jewish community had become the most important Jewish community in the world. The burden of leadership had crossed the Atlantic, whereas in the pre-war era, who were the wealthy communities that ran communal affairs? German Jewry, British Jewry. Okay, now it's going to be American Jewry. Jews suspected that the Holocaust had not changed the attitudes of the great powers and the citizens of the great power countries with regard to Jewish victimization. Nobody expected the United States to suddenly allow a flood of survivors to enter the country right away. And in fact, the survivors did not enter the country right away. It would take till 49, 50, 51, 52, 53. You know, some survivors were meandering around Europe for a long while, for a bunch of years, before they could get into America. Revelations about the Holocaust did not have a significant impact on American public opinion right away after the war. For example, and we could use cinema to prove the point, so the movie Stalag 17 never once mentioned anti-Semitism or the fate of the Jews, despite being about prison camps run by the Nazis. So why not? And the answer is that we're fighting one enemy at a time. And by the early 1950s, that enemy is Soviet Russia. And we can't afford to embarrass our German, West German allies by holding them accountable for the misdeeds of the past. So therefore, West Germany is a good guy now all of a sudden, and we don't talk about what they did to the Jews, because rather we're going to fight the Soviets. In the immediate post-war era, 60% of Americans supported a special limit on the number of Jewish displaced persons who could enter the United States. Only 10% of Americans favored unrestricted immigration on the part of displaced persons. So we see that immigration attitudes which had been thoroughly anti-Jewish in the 30s and early 40s during the war, continue to be not very pleasant in our direction. However, most Americans supported the Jewish side of the Palestine question, thinking that Jews have a historical and moral right to the land of Israel, and that a Jewish state would mean that America would not have to absorb so many Jews. So just like the Polish government, which was overtly anti-Semitic in the 1930s, had a favorable attitude towards Zionism because, hey, get them out of here and send them over there. So too, there was an element of that in the American attitude in the post-World War II era. Before the war, many Americans believed that Jews had objectionable traits, that they were unscrupulous, that they were greedy. And this was a real problem to be thought of in such a negative way. Will that change after the war? We'll see. The answer to that is yes. But not everyone changes their tune. So, for example, Senator Burton Wheeler of Montana blamed war propaganda on Hollywood Hitlers. In other words, that the Jews are making the Germans look bad and taking us into war. Modern American anti-Semitism peaked in 1944 during the war. But the question is, would it continue in the post-war era? So that was what American Jews had to ask themselves, that they understood we weren't very liked in the 1930s. Nobody wanted European Jews to come to America. The immigration quotas were very low. Father Coughlin hates our guts. Henry Ford hates our guts. You know, what's going to happen in the post-war era? So one perspective is the assimilationist impulse. That is to say, change your name, try to blend in, make sure nobody knows you're a Jew. In the show business, that was quite popular. So, for example, Nathan Birnbaum became who? Who's Nathan Birnbaum?
George Burns.
The guy, George Burns, good.
Oh, Birnbaum.
Betty Persky became who? Betty Persky. Lauren Bacall. She was a cousin of Shimon Peres, Persky. Okay, people change their name. Now, Gentile actors also change their names to spice it up sometimes, but Jews were looking to camouflage their identity. American Jews had no particular reason to be optimistic about the post-war era. After all, economic hardship breeds anti-Semitism, and it was assumed that there would be a post-war recession, that the wartime economy was an artificially inflated economy, and that when people came back, when the boys came home, there wouldn't necessarily be jobs for everybody, and we could have a return to the 1930s. So Jews would be scapegoated again. But there were certain events in September of 1945 that gave American Jews some hope that things might be different in America, that we could have a light at the end of the tunnel, that there'd be a better future. So one of those things was, on September 8th, 1945, in Atlantic City, New Jersey, who knows what happened?
A beauty pageant?
Correct, bingo. So Bess Meyerson wins the...
Bess Meyerson, yeah.
So Bess Meyerson was not an American Jew from the Gilded Ghetto or from an assimilationist family.
Right.
She was one of the Amcha. She was a girl from the Bronx, okay? So before there was Jennifer Lopez from the Bronx, there was Bess Meyerson from the Bronx, all right? And she lived in the Shalom Aleichem houses. Her parents were socialists. Real New York Jew, okay? Lower middle class, leftist-leaning politics, Yiddish-speaking, a real one of the Amcha. And her victory was a victory for all Eastern European Jews in America. The idea that, you know, finally one of our people has ascended to the pinnacle of American success. They say that there were even celebratory parties in the DP camps in Europe when they found out the news. Bess Meyerson refused to reduce the overt Jewishness of her persona. She was instructed to call herself Beth Meredith. And she said, no, I'm not going to take a fake stage name. Bess Meyerson. She was a true American Jewish princess, just as the fictional Marjorie Morningstar would be a decade later. Another thing that happened in September of 1945 was the other most famous Jew in America, notably Hank Greenberg. So on September 30th, 1945, Hank Greenberg came up in the ninth inning with the bases loaded, with the Tigers one win away from the AL pennant, and he hit a grand slam, a walk-off grand slam, to win the AL pennant for Detroit. He would go on to hit over 300 in the World Series with two home runs and seven RBIs as the Tigers defeated the Cubs. Of course, the Cubs never win. They went 108 years without winning. And was a real hero. So what's the story with Hank Greenberg? So baseball was seen as the path to Americanization, that the road to Americanization for the Greenhorn was ran right through Yankee Stadium, the Polo Grounds, and Ebbets Field. Greenberg grew up in Crotona Park in the Bronx, and he was an urban Jew boy who excelled at a game that was dominated by Gentiles from the small towns in America, in the heartland of America. He was a two-time AL MVP in 1935, 1940, and he was a Hall of Famer in 1956. He almost broke Babe Ruth's single-season home run record in 1938 when he had 58 home runs, but as many will know, towards the end of the season, he received a lot of pseudo-intentional walks. They weren't that exactly intentional walks, but the pitchers were pitching around. They did not want a Jew, a kike SOB, as they would call him, to break the Babe's record. Bear in mind that he's playing in Detroit. Detroit is the home of Henry Ford Coghlan, so we'd have, you know, a center of anti-Semitism, but also a lion of the Jewish people fighting back. Greenberg's most famous contribution to the cause of Judaism has been largely misunderstood. In 1934, he didn't play on Yom Kippur. He didn't play on Yom Kippur. But, and in fact, there was a little bit of a ditty written about that. I'll read it to you. It was a poem called Speaking of Greenberg. Came Yom Kippur, the holy fast day worldwide over to the Jew. And Hank Greenberg to his teaching and the old tradition true. Spent this day among his people and he didn't come to play. Said Murphy to Mulroney, we shall lose this game today. We shall miss him on the infield. We shall miss him at the bat. But he's true to his religion and I honor him for that. A very nice little poem. Well, what's the real story? Yes, we should be grateful that Hank skipped Yom Kippur and the ball field, but they had already won the pennant around Som Gedalia. And he did play on Rosh Hashanah when the pennant was still in doubt. And in fact, he hit two home runs that day. And the Reform rabbi in Detroit said it was a sign of divine approbation for his play. And on what's the legitimate Judaic reason for playing in Rosh Hashanah for the pennant? Because he's defending our city, Pikuach Nefesh. Rabbi for you. Now, Hank was enlisted in the army after Pearl Harbor right away. Him and Bob Feller were the first ball players of any renown to put their hand on the Bible and enlist. Okay, he was also the first star to come back to the big leagues after having been away for a while. So he missed 42, 43, 44, and he came back in July of 45. The war was not yet over in the Pacific, but he came home. And the question would be, was he still any good? Because plenty of ball players, after missing a bunch of years, came back and were not the same. I mean, even Joe DiMaggio wasn't the same after the war. But it turned out he was a good hitter. Hit 13 home runs, drove in 47 RBIs, hit 311 for the latter half of 1945, and took his team to the World Series. But what was Hank Greenberg's connection to Judaism, and why do I care? The answer is because, aside from the fact that he was a symbol, a secular saint of American Judaism, he also was indicative of larger trends in American Jewish life. So his first wife was a Jew. She was the daughter of Gimbel's department store.
Really?
Wealthy Jewish heiress, and had a few kids with her. But he was married by a justice of the peace, not by a rabbi. And after he retired from playing, he became a GM for the Indians, and he got divorced. And he married a shiksa for the second wife. And he never joined a synagogue, never gave his kids a Jewish education, and didn't have a Jewish funeral when he died in 1986. So Hank Greenberg regarded Judaism and even Jewish identity as the drab Jewishness of the immigrant generation of his parents that he wanted to have nothing to do with. So he wasn't ashamed to be a Jew. and he never denied his Jewish identity. He just thought it was another ethnic identity like anybody else would have had in America, and one that, you know, you don't really have to do much about. It's a reality of your life, but you can walk away from it to whatever extent you feel like. And so he did. However, he was supportive of Israel. So like many second-generation American Jews, he was pro-Israel, but wasn't religious and wasn't really interested in sustaining Jewish culture. He just, would punch back against anti-Semitism if he had to. Okay. So for many American Jews, Bess Meyerson, Hank Greenberg were these secular saints. They were as American as apple pie on the 4th of July, but as Jewish as Knishes and Yom Kippur, at least if that's what you thought Judaism was. Okay. Well, some people regarded the success of Eastern European Jews in popular American culture as a sign that the 75 years of Yekid domination was over. That for a long time, they said, more Polish and less Polish. That don't reveal your Ostjuden identity. That the Yekis were the elite, and they wanted the Ostjuden to try to rid themselves of any overt Jewishness. But in 1945, the Deutsche were defeated, both the Nazis and, culturally speaking, the German Jews in America, and the hour of the Litvak has arrived. You know, finally, the Russian Jews, the Litvak, can be proud of himself on the American scene. Okay. Military service broadened the American Jewish cultural horizon, and people began to realize that there was no longer a conflict between the two sides of their identity, between the Jewish aspect of their identity and the American aspect of their identity, and that anti-Semitism was un-American. Okay, the Nazis were against America and they were against the Jews, so therefore anti-Semitism is un-American. And we're going to fight back. I have a new militancy in stamping out anti-Semitism. In 1946, the Jewish Welfare Board did what American Jews had done after World War I and after the Civil War. And that is to put together a volume, a book, proving and detailing American Jewry's contribution to the war effort. That there were 500,000 Jews in the service, 11,000 Jews died, that 24,000 Jews were wounded, that 36,000 Jews were decorated with honors, okay, that we did our fair share. In 1948, Jews were instrumental in getting the Postal Service to issue a stamp of the USS Dorchester and the death of the four chaplains, including Rabbi Goody. So this is what's being done to stamp out old anti-Semitism in America. From a cinematography point of view, in 1949, there were the Sands of Iwo Jima, the movie. And in that movie, there's a scene where a Jewish GI dies on the beaches of Iwo Jima while reciting the Shema, covering his eyes and saying the Shema. Okay, so this was showing that America's army was not just some waspy Protestant army, but rather was a diverse army. And all the platoon movies, the platoon-type movies of that era showed a heterogeneous military with some kid from Texas and some kid from Ohio and a Jew from Brooklyn, that there was always a mixed unit. This was, by the way, a departure from the desemitized movies of the 1930s, that the Jewish people controlled Hollywood, undoubtedly so, but in the 1930s, Jewish Hollywood was reluctant to show Jews. They desemitized all their movies. By the late 40s, that was no longer the case. Now we're willing to show Jews and their contribution to American life. However, the turning point in Hollywood was 1947, as Asher mentions in the chat, A Gentleman's Agreement with Gregory Peck. So there were two major movies that were nominated for the Academy Awards, and they were Crossfire and Gentleman's Agreement. In Crossfire, a Gentile officer in the Navy kills a Jewish subordinate, and Robert Mitchum plays the lead character, who's trying to show that the anti-Semitism of the commanding officer was totally unwarranted. And because the commanding officer who killed the guy said, well, Jews don't really fight. And Robert Mitchum's response is, you ought to look at the casualty list. There are a lot of funny names there too, meaning that Jews were wounded and died in battle together with normal sounding American names. In Gentleman's Agreement with Gregory Peck, so here someone pretends to be a Jew, a journalist pretends to be a Jew while writing an article about anti-Semitism, and it shows that genteel anti-Semitism of the upper crust could only exist by virtue of this agreement, this gentleman's agreement to keep Jews out of certain elite parts of society. There's a question. Robert Mitchum and Robert Ryan were proved to be anti-Semitic. Any truth? Not that I'm aware of. I mean, Robert Mitchum played pro-Jewish characters in a bunch of movies, including Herman Wouk's War and Remembrance. So I would tend to think that he wasn't a Jew hater, but who knows? There's an interesting response that one of the stagehands had who was working on Gentleman's Agreement. He said, "I'll never be rude to a Jew again." Why? It might turn out that he's a Gentile. So that was an odd reaction to Gentleman's Agreement, but it made its point. Now, Herman Wouk wrote many books, in which some turned into screenplay, on these topics about rooting out anti-Semitism and the place of the Jew in American life, that the Jew had contributed to the war effort. Herman Wouk's Cain Mutiny and This Is My God. And Wouk believed that being Jewish was like being in the Navy. You have a funny uniform, you have strict discipline, limits on your freedom, but it's for a noble cause. That was his comparison between Judaism and being in the Navy. Okay. Well, one of the ways that anti-Semitism was going to be fought by institutional and establishment American Judaism was through a new publication. And that was Commentary, sponsored by the American Jewish Committee, beginning in 1945. And Jewish writers and intellectuals, it was believed, had something to tell the rest of the country. The editor was Elliot Cohen, a staunch anti-communist. And he wanted his publication to treat Jewish issues seriously and bring the life of the mind into the public sphere. And also to bring Jewish intellectuals back into the mainstream, because Jewish intellectuals, so we're going to get to quotas soon enough. Jewish intellectuals had been estranged from American intellectual life more broadly, and even from the Jewish community, because they were too radical politically. So the goal is to bring them back into the mainstream and listen to what they have to say. But there were those who didn't like this mainstreaming of American Jewish intellectual life. So Irving Howe wrote a rebuttal and established the magazine Dissent, which was a big failure. And he complained about the age of conformity, that American Jewish intellectuals were buying into capitalism and bourgeois society. Okay. But post-World War II era was a golden age for American Jewry. And Jews entered all facets of American life. Yes, the quotas, many of them were eliminated from elite universities, and Jews were able to enter professions that had up to that point been closed off to them, whether insurance or high banking and the like, and white shoe law firms. There was still some residual opposition to Jewish entry, but for the most part, it went away. And a Jew ran for president in 1964. And as everybody would claim, the first Jewish president would be an Episcopalian, Barry Goldwater. Okay, that was the classic joke of the time. What was a big failure was American Zionism. Jews don't move to Israel. Why not? Because the Jews in America are having a golden age. It's great here. Why would we leave? And not next week, but the week after, we'll spend a session on American Zionism after 1948. What is it all about? Does it have a purpose? So American Jews, despite their success, still had a siege mentality. The insecurity remained. The assumption that around the corner was vicious anti-Semitism, even here, was still on the minds of many American Jews. In 1949, Eli Ginsberg, the son of Louis Ginsberg, the great Talmudist of JTS, so his son Eli was a sociologist and economist at Columbia, he wrote a book, Agenda for American Jews, and he said, we have a problem here. The problem is that for most American Jews who aren't religious, what's going on? What is their emphasis? Their focus is anti-Semitism. But you can't have a vibrant community if all you have is anti-Semitism without any positive content. Would there be positive content that would develop over the next 50, 60 years to go alongside the anti-Semitism? Well, arguably, yes, but it was pretty schwach, which is why we have a horrible assimilation. Okay, so most Jews disbelieved the polling data about the decline of anti-Semitism. They said, look to Germany. that Germany, it was bad, and then it was good after the emancipation, and then it got really bad, and the Nazis took over and killed everyone. So even though it's a little bit better, it doesn't mean it isn't going to backslide and get worse. The willingness to believe the worst was especially true in certain declining middle-class neighborhoods in, you know, urban New York and other East Coast cities. And that explains not in the 1950s, but in the 1960s, the phenomenon of the JDL and Meyer Kahane. That, you know, the headlines in the Jewish press were always, oh, the worst is coming, you know, they're out to get us. And was it really true? No, but it made for sensationalist headlines and a lot of people believed it. But it wasn't only the uneducated or unsophisticated who believed it. In the late 40s, early 50s, even very educated Jews thought that the worst was around the corner. Okay. Theodor Adorno wrote in 1950, The Authoritarian Personality. Very important book in American intellectual history, The Authoritarian Personality by Adorno, who was who had escaped from Europe and had come to the United States, part of the Frankfurt School. People feared the worst about Joe McCarthy, Senator Joe McCarthy. It looked like the authoritarian personality described by Adorno was coming to fruition in Joe McCarthy. But the truth of the matter is, McCarthy turned out to not be an anti-Semite. Well, I don't know what he had in his heart, but Lemaisa, in the open world, McCarthyism did not go after the Jews as Jews. They went after some Jews as communists, but not Jews as Jews. And, you know, Roy Cohn was his sidekick, for whatever that's worth. But moreover, Gerald K. Smith, who was the leading anti-Semite in America in the 1950s, he blamed McCarthy and disavowed him as being a sellout precisely because McCarthy did not connect Judaism and communism. Okay. Well, what about the Rosenberg case? So a few years back, we did a whole session on the Rosenbergs, the heroes and villains of modern Jewish history. And we're not going to go through the whole thing now, but I just want to emphasize the reaction of the Jewish community to the Rosenberg case. So not a single Jew was on the jury, despite New York City being 30% Jewish. So if you wanted to say that the deck was stacked against the Rosenbergs for anti-Semitic reasons, you could point to the composition of the jury pool and say it shouldn't have been that way. But Jewish leaders understood that the Rosenbergs were bad news, and they did whatever they could to have damage control and to say that the USSR was an enemy of Zionism, of Judaism, and the Jewish people. So, you know, don't think that we, the Jews of America, are pro-Soviet. We're not. The Soviet Union hates our guts, and we hate them back. And that these Rosenberg characters were an aberration. Also, this is happening at the same time as the doctor's plot and the Prague trials. So, you know, it was the height of Soviet communist opposition to world Jewry. Mainstream Jewish groups denied, vigorously denied, that the Rosenbergs were a new version of the Dreyfus affair, that this was simply not the case, that Dreyfus was innocent and the Rosenbergs were guilty as sin. The American Jewish community openly supported the death penalty for the Rosenbergs. Now that's saying something. They openly supported the death penalty for the Rosenbergs. Did they really feel that way? Maybe. Or did they feel they had to say that just, you know, to push the enemies of the Jews away from the community? I don't know, but they openly called for the death penalty. Even other groups that opposed the death penalty for the Rosenbergs did not have a problem with the verdict. They understood they were guilty. It's just a question of how far does the punishment go. And there were those who argued that since Klaus Fuchs and Alan Nunn May, who had spied nuclear subversion, did not get the death penalty, therefore the Rosenbergs also should not get the death penalty. The Rosenberg case weakened the American Jewish left, the American Jewish far left. They were blacklisted by the community. And after Khrushchev's speech in 1956 at the 20th Party of Congress, in which he spoke against Stalin's crimes, the American Jewish communists basically were disillusioned completely. And they were shattered. They were broken. Some of them found solace in Zionism, and some of them found solace in old line religious Judaism. But the American Jewish old line left was dead as a result of that. Anyone who wants to claim that the Rosenberg case was handled in an anti-Semitic fashion also has to bear in mind that the prosecutor, Irving Sapel, and the judge, Irving Kaufman, were both Jews. And there was no anti-Semitic backlash in this country after the Rosenberg trial. There simply wasn't. In my own family, my grandmother used to say that she could never forgive Ethel Rosenberg, not for the crime of spying for the Soviet Union, but rather for the crime of not cooperating with the government in order to reduce her penalty, because she could have gotten life imprisonment had she just been willing to talk. And she wasn't willing to talk, and she died. And shame on her, because she had two small children, and she made them orphans because she wouldn't talk. That was the way my grandmother approached the Ethel Rosenberg situation. It was her fault. She allowed herself to die and orphan her children. Okay. The notion of the Jew as a radical severely declined in the post-war era. In 1948, one-fifth of Americans did not want Jewish neighbors. By 1959, it was down to 2%. That's a pretty good improvement in just a decade. In 1962, only 4% of Americans said they would support a candidate who was anti-Semitic just because he was anti-Semitic. The idea that it could happen here was becoming phobic, paranoid, and even amusing. That's not to say there was nobody in government who was out and out anti-Semite. You had one. John Rankin was a longtime congressman from Mississippi. He was bounced from Congress because he took anti-Semitism too far. He saw a conspiracy of Jewish race mixers, communists, and gold bugs wherever he went. And he accused the long-nosed reprobates of trying to undermine segregation in the South. Which brings us to the South. Let's talk about the South. You know, George Wallace, not exactly a tzaddik, of Alabama, who ran for president 3 times, did not use anti-Semitism. In fact, he had some Jewish supporters, and he would trot them out. When he wanted to get northern votes to show, hey, look, I have some Jewish supporters. Israel was admired in the American South. Why? Well, it's the Bible Belt. And there's another reason why Israel was admired in the South, especially in the late 40s, between 48 and mid 60s. And that is because the South lost a war. You know, the Civil War was 100 years earlier, 90 years earlier, and the South lost. And they understood the idea of being threatened militarily by people who don't like you. So they understood Israel's need for military advantage in a hostile sea of the Arab world. So in the South, Israel was very much beloved. The big problem for Southern Jews was Northern Jewish liberal agitators fighting for civil rights. And we're going to spend a session discussing Jews in the civil rights movement and Jews in the Vietnam War, hopefully in about 3 weeks from now. But from a Southern Jewish perspective of anti-Semitism, this was a problem. That here you have boys, kids from the North, college kids coming down and making a tumult. There were synagogue bombings in 1958 all throughout the American South that it was attributed to, you know, Northern agitators getting people angry. In the South, you know, they didn't view the Jewish people as a people. They viewed the Jews as a religious sect, not as a religious ethnic group, which means there are Northern Baptists and there are Southern Baptists. There are Northern Jews and there are Southern Jews. And the Southern Jews, they have Southern attitudes about race relations, about governance, about American culture. And the Northern Jews, they have a different attitude, but we're not going to blame the Southerners for the attitude of the Northerners. Was this perspective by the Gentiles of the South an accurate understanding of American Jewish communal life? The answer is no. They were wrong, but they were wrong to our advantage in the sense that they didn't hold it against the South the way that the North perceived race relations. Ben Halpern, in the 1960s, professor at Brandeis, said that the polls don't tell the truth. Why not? Because people say what they think the pollster wants them to say, or what they think they're supposed to say, but not how they actually feel. And so all the data that indicates a decline in anti-Semitism was, in the eyes of certain academic scholars and Jewish communal leaders, not to be relied upon. It only showed that the respectability of anti-Semitism had gone down, but not that anti-Semitism itself had actually gone down. Of course, the biggest proof that anti-Semitism had gone down was the willingness of Gentiles to marry Jews. Intermarriage we regarded as a problem from the standpoint of Jewish religious survival and ethnic survival. But from the standpoint of, you know, how bigoted is the country and how anti-Semitic is a country, if they're willing to marry you, they can't hate you that badly. What about the KKK? So the KKK was in decline in the post-war era. It had had its moment in the sun in the 1920s and 30s, and it would come back in the South, you know, during the civil rights era. But in the immediate post-war era, it declined. Okay. So Seymour Martin Lipset, a big sociologist, in 1990 said, "The Jews are full of foreboding, despite all their wealth, power, and repute." And he quoted Abba Eban as, "The Jews are a people that can't take yes for an answer. Can't take yes for an answer." In 1989, the survey indicated that 75% of American Jews thought that anti-Semitism was a very serious problem. Very serious problem. In 1974, Forster and Epstein, two big machers, you know, in the Jewish communal life, wrote the book, The New Anti-Semitism. And basically they argued that Jews had been lulled into thinking that they have a false sense of security. And that the new anti-Semitism is that Gentiles are insufficiently sensitive to Jewish sensitivities, and they're insufficiently pro-Israel. There were those who argued this was political blackmail. You're accusing somebody of anti-Semitism because they're not sufficiently pro-Israel. That's not fair. Okay. In 1982, Nathan and Ruth Perlmutter wrote The Real Anti-Semitism in America. And they argued that there is anti-Semitism in America, but it isn't the old kind. It's a new kind and a real one. And where is it emanating from? So listen to this list from 1982 about where supposedly the real anti-Semitism is coming from. Political radicals, black militants, pro-Arab spokesmen, those doing business with Arab countries, neo-isolationists, supporters of affirmative action, opponents of a strong national defense. So that's a motley crew. You know, proponents of affirmative action are people to the political left. The radicals are to the political left. The black militants to the political left. But the pro-Arab folks were to the political right. The business folks, the Chamber of Commerce, the old line GOP Chamber of Commerce crowd that wanted to do business with the Saudi Arabia are the Republicans. The neo-isolationists is Pat Buchanan. So you have a bizarre amalgam of non-whites on one side of the aisle and sort of racist and pro-Arab whites on the other side of the aisle. And you could argue to this adayom hazeh that alignment holds true. You have anti-Semitism one side and the other. But this was noticed already in the early 80s. Americans tended not to blame Jews for the oil crisis of the 1970s. The American Jewish communal leadership was afraid that in the post-Yom Kippur war era, that the oil embargo was going to be bad for our community. It turned out to have no effect whatsoever. Also, most Americans were totally unaware that in the 1980s, the major fraudsters like Boesky and Milken were Jewish. I mean, anybody who read the paper knew that, but most people don't read the paper, and they weren't paying attention. One of the things that happened starting in the late 70s, early 80s, was that Jews began getting elected to Congress, the House and the Senate, not only from states like New York or Pennsylvania or Massachusetts that had significant Jewish populations, but even from places like Montana, Utah, Idaho, Nebraska, random out of the way places which had a very small Jewish population would elect a Jewish senator or a Jewish congressman. Why? Because political anti-Semitism was over. People voted for whoever they voted for. Okay. So where did anti-Semitism survive in post-World War II American society? The answer is in the social realm of the elite clubs and certain schools, but for the most part, Jews didn't care. Jews didn't care. Why? Because they preferred the company of Jews anyway. They weren't looking to break into certain clubs and the like. Yes, there were certain neighborhoods that had codicils that maybe Jews wanted to move into, and those codicils had to be overturned. Fine. But with the move to suburbia, Jews developed the 5 o'clock shadow. What's the 5 o'clock shadow? Where at 5 o'clock, when you go home from work, everybody takes the train home or takes the Long Island Expressway in their car home, but you get off at one exit and the goy gets off at another exit. The Jew gets off the LIE at exit 33 and goes down Middle Neck Road into Great Neck. And the goy gets off at exit 34, 35 and gets off at New Hyde Park Road or goes into Searingtown or wherever, Port Washington. So the idea is everybody's going to suburbia, but we'll live in different parts of suburbia. And even within the same suburb, it's the edge of friendliness. You're friendly, but you're not friends. Friendly, but not friends. Okay. Why did the obsession with anti-Semitism remain so strong? Why did it remain so strong? If it was an absurdity almost, if Jews took it way too far, given the pleasant reality of post-war American life, why did it retain its strength, this emphasis, this focus? Well, because certain Jews wanted to identify Jewishly, but they were not religious in the least, and they had dropped all pretense of Jewish culture. All they had left was to fight perceived bigotry. That was their one mitzvah. Their one mitzvah left was not Shabbos, not kashrus, not even eating Jewish deli, okay, which could be treif, but rather to fight anti-Semitism. And for that matter, also to become pro-Israel and anti-Arab. That's another angle. Acculturation meant that the distinction between Jews and Gentiles in the post-war era was largely a matter of religion. The irony of this, of course, is that it came at a time of declining religious observance amongst Jews. But the Gentiles didn't see it that way. They thought Jews are different religiously, and they thought Jews are religious, because after all, they build temples and temple this and Jewish center that. They didn't realize that Jews were being as irreligious as ever. Rabbis benefited from all this. Rabbis were elevated in the public space, and it came to be known as Protestant Catholic Jew that there were three major religions in the United States, courtesy of Will Herberg's 1955 book, okay? Religion was a big deal in post-war America. President Eisenhower said so. President Eisenhower famously said, "Our government makes no sense unless it is founded in deeply felt religious faith. And I don't care what it is." In other words, you got to be deeply religious. And I don't give a damn what religion it is. So as long as it's a religion. We're fighting atheistic Russia, so you need to have religion. So Jews had religion. Barely, but they had it. Okay. One of the things that happens in the post-war era, this is important, is that the mysterious aura about Jews dissipated. Jews don't have horns anymore. Now, the truth of the matter is, Jews never had horns, but the goyim didn't know that. If you were a Gentile from a small town, a farm boy from Middle America, you didn't know the Jews didn't have horns. They had a mysterious aura about them. So during the war, when you were in the trenches with a fellow soldier who happened to be a Jew, you realized he didn't have horns. He was a normal person like everybody else. In the post-war era, this progressed even further, and the aura about Jews was gone. They're just like everybody else. You might not like them. Well, you may like them, but they're not bizarre. They're not so different. Okay. After the war, and this is much more so after the Six-Day War of 1967, but already even after World War II, there is a move to replace the 1930s attitude of what will the goyim think, obsessing over wondering what will the goyim think if I do this, that, or the other thing, to a process to a place of more militant expression of Jewish identity. And if in the 1930s, when Ramaz was founded, okay, in 1937, the Upper East Side, okay, Rabbi Joseph Fluckstein established the Ramaz Academy, named after his grandfather-in-law, okay, and he told the students, a yarmulke is an indoor garment. A yarmulke is an indoor garment. You don't wear the yarmulke outside. Well, in the post-war era, you can wear the yarmulke outside. We're willing to express our identity a little bit more. Not everybody does, but those who wanted to, who really wanted to, were less afraid to do so. In the few minutes we have left, just a few points about the 1980s, jumping ahead a little bit on anti-Semitism. When it came to Pollard, and I don't want to spend the whole session on Pollard because it's too dangerous and I'll say something that people won't like, but the Conference of Presidents supported the life sentence for Pollard. This was 1985, he was arrested. 1987, he was sentenced. Conference of Presidents supported the life sentence. The reaction by certain folks in Israel, including Shlomo Avineri, the academic, he blasted the Conference of Presidents as having a typical diaspora mentality, that they're so obsessed and worried over, oh, what will the Gentiles think if we don't throw Pollard under the bus? It'll be bad for American Jews, so we have to throw him under the bus. And the Israelis thought that that was a shameful thing by the American Jews. But Avineri wasn't really right. He was a little bit right, but he was also very wrong, because there were plenty of American Jews in the Pollard case who, like in the Rosenberg case, said, listen, the guy was guilty of sin and he damaged our communal interests. And it's not just that we're afraid what will the American Gentiles do to our community, our American Jewish community, but rather that we as Americans are very much upset by somebody committing treason or someone spying for another country. And so, Jew or Gentile, doesn't matter who he is, he deserves to go to the slammer forever. That was an attitude that many American Jews had, including in the leadership class, that Israelis just couldn't understand. So the Israelis were looking down upon the American Jews, oh, diaspora mentality. No, the Israelis didn't understand the Americans. The Americans had real sincere feelings here. Okay. Now, most Americans never heard of Pollard and didn't know he was Jewish. Why? As I said, most Americans don't read the newspaper. Most American voters are dumb. Okay, we rely upon the ignorance of our fellow citizens so that when one of our own does something wrong, they don't hold it against us because they don't know any better. That's, we should not underestimate that component of our survival. Okay. However, there were those who took the opposite approach. For example, in 1989, Rabbi Avi Weiss, okay, of Hebrew Institute of Riverdale, HIR, went to the jail in Marion, Illinois, and held a Freedom Seder outside on Pesach, you know, celebrating Pollard as a hero of Am Yisrael. Okay, but that was a minority opinion, in my view. Another thing that happened in the 1980s was the Bitburg controversy of 1985, where President Reagan said before the 84 election he was going to go visit Germany, and he does in 1985, and he goes to Bitburg where 47 SS officers were buried. At first, the Americans didn't realize that, but when it was found out, he didn't change his plans. So what happened? Elie Wiesel, who was being awarded the Congressional Gold Medal of Achievement, the highest civilian honor in America, had a White House ceremony. And he said to Ronald Reagan to his face, you know, you don't belong in Bitburg. An American president doesn't belong in a place where SS officers, where Nazis are buried. That you're the enemy of the Nazis, not a friend of the Nazis. So he chastised an American president in the White House. What does that tell you? That for all the worry about anti-Semitism in the post-war era, the bottom line is Jews were at home in America and very comfortable. And yes, it took a certain measure of courage for Wiesel to do that, but he was able to do it in part because the vast majority of the American Congress also was against the Bitburg visit and agreed with Wiesel. So he wasn't standing alone upstaging an American president. He was together with public opinion and the majority of the House. Okay. I'll take questions now. Take questions. Questions. No questions. Everybody's very quiet tonight. Okay, so in the chat, there was a question about at what point did the ADL start keeping statistics on anti-Semitism? The answer is immediately. The ADL was founded in 1913, and they were keeping statistics from day one. But their ability to collect statistics improved dramatically in the post-war era because they had access to more resources and there was more reporting going on. Another question in the chat was, what about the post-war State Department? So the post-war State Department was anti-Jewish. It wasn't just anti-Israel. Yes, John Dulles was no friend of the Jews and no friend of Israel, but it wasn't just him. The State Department generally had an anti-Jewish bias. The only state Secretary of State who was otherwise was George Shultz. George Shultz was a big friend of our people. How did the Six-Day War change American Jewry? So we're going to spend a session on that. Someone says, I disagree with your views on Pollard. Well, I haven't actually said any of my views on Pollard. I just tried to explain what the views of leading American figures in the 1980s was on Pollard, the pro and con, and that Israel tended to misunderstand what American Jewish thinking really was. If you want my own view, I'll tell you privately.
Can I ask a question?
Okay. Yes, ask a question.
Oh, you heard me good. I forgot what I was going to. Oh, yeah. Nixon, according to his tapes, was not a friend of the Jews, and yet he bailed. He was able to send, weapons that helped Israel, in the Egyptian front. They needed those weapons.
Yeah, sure.
So how do you explain that? That he was really personally against Jewish people, and yet he helped us out.
Well, the answer is that American Jews and Israel are two different things. American Jews are Jews, and Jews, people don't like Jews. There's a lot of anti-Semitism in the world, including from Nixon. Israel is not Jewish. Israel is Israel. Israel is a country in the Cold War, an ally of the United States, a strong military. You could very easily, as an American president, adopt a pro-Israel position, even if domestically you didn't like Jews because they were too liberal, or because you had Christian anti-Judaism. There are a whole host of reasons to dislike domestic Jews, and yet still have a favorable attitude towards a sovereign state 7,000 miles away. And Nixon is an example of that, but not the only example.
Did you speak about the pawnbroker movie?
I have not seen that movie. I heard a little bit about it, but I never saw it.
All right, you'll see it.
I'll have to watch it. Questions.
Program to build the atomic bomb.
Yeah, Manhattan Project.
It's interesting. There were quite a few Nazis who were taken out. These German scientists who were taken out and used, for their expertise to bomb, etc. And that didn't seem to bother anybody. But what happened with Ethel Rosenberg? I mean, in the sense that she wasn't a Nazi. Was she homegrown? Was she from Europe? What was your story?
Ethel Rosenberg, like many other New York Jews, was a fan of the Soviet Union, was an avowed communist, and believed that if the United States was going to develop nuclear weapons, the Soviet Union should have it too.
Uh-huh.
The great defense of the Rosenbergs, among those who wanted it, who were inclined to defend them, was that at the time of their illegal behavior, the Soviet Union was not an enemy of the United States, but rather was a World War II ally. And that at worst, she was simply passing along information that would help the war effort of a country that was together with us in fighting Nazism and fascism. That was, if you wanted to try to defend her, that's what you could say. Of course, by 1953, the Soviet Union was not an ally of the United States. This is long past, Yalta and the conference at Tehran. This is now, the last gasp of the Stalin era when they're the mortal enemy of the United States. So that kind of defense, didn't go over very well. But Ethel and Julius were far from the only ones who believed that the Soviet Union was a wonderful workers' paradise and ought to have all the tools in its defense, as did the United States.
The tragedy there was that the person that should have been taken to task and executed was their relative who was out in New Mexico.
Yes, the brother-in-law really was the major guilty party, and he turned against his own family members, and he was able to live. And he died not that long ago.
Correct.
I wonder if the Jewish Roy Cohn helped to blunt any attempts to brush Jews as being less than loyal.
So that's a very interesting question. People are reluctant to ascribe anything positive to Roy Cohn.
I know.
He's a loathsome character. So for in a discussion of American Jewish history, where we're obviously partisan, to say that somebody did something to blunt the force of anti-Semitism is a mitzvah. To say Roy Cohn did any mitzvah is a little out of bounds. So right. It may be true, but I don't know, and I can't tell you that.
I'm a little bit hazy on that part of history. What happened there? How did they find out that they were doing this? Was the brother-in-law a pigeon? Is that what happened?
There was evidence that leaked because they were not so careful with how they handled information. And so if you combine what the government was able to find on its own with what their co-conspirators said against them once they turned state's witness, they didn't have a chance.
And yet the head of the Manhattan Project was a Jew, a German Jew, Oppenheimer.
So Oppenheimer was later accused of not being so patriotic. Despite being the head of the Manhattan Project and being a major, you know, contributor to the war effort, his post-war life was not so pleasant. And he also died fairly young because he was he had cancer. But people accused him of having political leanings that were out of bounds, and that he wanted to, there were those who wanted to blacklist him and say that he's traif. So it was unfortunate for him. Okay, we'll stop here. Next time, we'll do something a little more pleasant than anti-Semitism. We're going to discuss to the Golden Cities, the Jews moved to the Sun Belt, to Miami, to Los Angeles, and to warm weather locations. So we'll have a little
fun. How about the rush to Long Island? Were they part of that?
The rush to Long Island, you're traveling at 10 miles per hour on the LIE.
Levittown.
Next time. Yeah.